Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille. And our show today is about a single word.
Yeah, one that seems to be getting a lot of play. You could even say it's kind of having a moment.
It even got an update on the Oxford English Dictionary this summer.
I'll read you the formal definition in my best Oxford English Dictionary voice. Alert to injustice in society, especially racism.
Okay, that was a good voice.
Thank you.
And that's an easy definition. That's the definition for woke.
Yep. And if you're a longtime listener, then you can probably guess we'd end up here eventually.
After all, the word woke is part of our new tagline, one we debuted just a couple months ago at a very fun rooftop relaunch party.
Yeah, and it was at that party that we started asking all kinds of folks to give us their own definition of woke.
Hashtag get woke.
It's taking those blinders off and becoming aware.
Whether that's an underprivileged community, underrepresented community, those trends and those subtleties that are affecting the community that you can't ignore anymore.
Basically what it means to me is like you're not racist, you're not sexist, you're not heteronormative or like have those ideas, you're not misogynistic, you know, so on and so forth. So you're accepting, you're not ignorant, basically, is what it means to me. So, yeah.
And it's sort of like the difference between being sympathetic and being empathetic.
Clearly, these people were having the best time of their woke lives with us.
Yeah, I mean, we're awesome people to hang out with, don't you think?
Yeah.
There was drinks involved, too, by
the way. There was. Anyway, back to that word. We've actually been asking a bunch of people what they think of it.
And our plan was to bring you guys an episode a little later this year with everyone's responses.
But look, we got busy, we pushed it off, and well, it kind of got shelved. And then a couple weeks ago, some big breaking harrowing news happened.
Virginia's governor declared a state of emergency in Charlottesville today as white nationalists clashed in the streets with counter-protesters. Groups including the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis came from across the country to rally against plans to remove a Confederate statue from a park. The violence included an apparent attack with a car on a crowd of peaceful protesters. At least one person was killed. This all took place a short distance.
So listen, by now you've probably heard or read a bunch about what happened in Charlottesville, especially the political fallout from President Donald Trump's remarks about white supremacists and anti-racist protesters.
Well, it's all leading to now.
This is Northwestern University African American Studies professor Barner Hesse. He's the creator of the wildly popular 8 White Identities.
So if you've never seen the 8 White Identities scale, basically it maps out the different types of white people, from white supremacist to abolitionist.
You know, one of the paradoxes of the resurgence of white supremacy, when I say the resurgence, you just have to think about 5 or 6 years ago, the term white supremacy would never be used in the media. And the paradox is that increasingly what we have are white people talking to white people. You know, when the alt-right are marching in Charlottesville and they're saying, you know, you will not replace us, who are they speaking to? They're actually speaking to white people. And that's one of the distinctive sort of changes in the post-war period, is that you cannot simply assume that all white people are on the same page.
So on today's episode, we're going back through the responses we've been collecting about the word woke, and we spend time with regular people, many of them white, trying to figure out, in light of everything going on, where they fit on the spectrum.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
We're going to take you guys on a little journey as we explore the woke spectrum, especially for white people. We'll make 3 stops. First up is the Forest Park campus of St. Louis Community College. We're here to meet Nick Marty.
Hey, are you Nick?
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, I'm Tim. Nice to meet you, man. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, anytime.
Nick is 25 years old and studying biology, and he just got done with class for the day.
To me, being woke means having a deeper understanding and actually taking some sort of part in you know, whether it be political or educational, anything, any kind of thing outside of yourself.
Nick says he doesn't really see wokeness as being all about race.
There could be different levels of wokeness, you know, depending on what you're aware of and how willing you are to accept certain things as truth.
These days he works as a community paramedic in North St. Louis County. That means he does routine medical checkups on top of responding to emergencies, and he helps his patients connect with different social services.
Given that Nick considers himself to be a woke guy, what happens when one of his buddies, especially if they're white, says something racist?
I'll tease the crap out of them. You know, we like to, I guess we call it ribbing each other. We tear each other up every once in a while, just making jokes and stuff at each other. But if somebody were to make something like that, then of course we would start making jokes at their expense, you know. Now, nobody of my friend group that I know of has been necessarily racist or bigoted, but if they were, then yeah, I definitely would have to check it.
Our next stop is a mid-century ranch-style house in suburban St. Louis County. This area is full of homes like this, with sizable yards and mature trees. We're about to meet up with a longtime resident.
Hi, Joan. How are you?
Fine.
Nice to meet you. I'm Tim.
Hi. Come on in. Yeah. My name is Joan Brannigan, and I live in Olivet.
Joan is 74 years old and has lived in this area for about 40 years. And here's how she defines woke.
It means that as long as there's racism, I have to keep working on myself and my community to break that, to get rid of racism. And it's not an easy job on myself, and it's not an easy job on the community.
And after Ferguson, she and a group of mostly white members of the United Church of Christ started a website called racialjusticestl.com. It lists racial justice events in the St. Louis area.
But Joan says sometimes the hardest thing to do is check in with yourself. She recently went through a YWCA program called Witnessing Whiteness.
In it, white folks get together and unpack their whiteness and racism as a group. And that's led to some tough realizations.
Of that, I was able to see racial things happening to me and to my friends and to people around me, and I was letting it go, and I wasn't speaking out. And I think what I took away from that is now every time I see something, I have to say something.
Just like Nick, Joan thinks of her wokeness as a continuum, not a fixed location.
And she says among her circle of friends, not much has changed since Charlottesville.
Because my circle of friends is basically people in my tribe who kind of think the same way that I do. Mm-hmm.
You know, you had mentioned, well, I'm sort of in my tribe and I don't really know, like, I don't talk to a lot of white people who are outside of my tribe, you know, in terms of sentiments about racism being awful and sort of working on yourself and working on your community. And I kind of often find that I'm sort of in that position as well. And sometimes I worry that part of that, I mean, that feels good, that feels very comfortable, but part of the problem is that people who are white people who are thinking about race and racism don't go talk to other white people who aren't thinking about race and racism.
Right. I don't have the courage to take myself to those places. If they happen, I'm going to, you know, I'm now from after taking this class that I feel like I'm going to stand up for what I believe, what I think is right. And I don't even really know how to take myself to places where there are people that are so, in my mind, prejudiced about black people mm-hmm. and brown people, too. Yeah, I just say stay woke and try and see racism every place you can and do what you can to stop it.
All right, so we've got a couple of perspectives on what it means to be white and woke and how wokeness can be a spectrum, but we really need some larger context.
It's time for our final stop, the campus of St. Louis University. Right around the corner from our office, actually. And we're here to catch up with Kira Banks.
I'm an associate professor of psychology at St. Louis University. So I study racial identity and how it impacts mental health.
And Banks says being woke is like definitely a thing right now.
So when I teach about these concepts, I often talk with students about how a fish in water doesn't know it's wet, right? And so to be woke means to be aware of the systems around you, to be aware that you're wet, and to then be able to make a decision and a choice about how you then move through the world.
But Banks says, let's not get this twisted, academically speaking.
So just to be clear, I don't use the term woke in my work necessarily in terms of the classroom, but I always work to connect the academic concepts I talk about with current lingo.
All right, so fair enough. But at the same time, this idea of wokeness being a spectrum actually does have some theoretical underpinnings.
So I would actually say it relates to racial identity development theory.
Students who take Kira's classes this fall will hear a lot more about this. But we convinced the professor to share a little with you guys, too. So consider this next part a mini lecture of sorts on racial identity development theory. You might want to take notes.
Because there are differences between how this works for non-whites and white people. So let's start with non-white people.
I'll give you one that's kind of general. Okay. You don't have to have a racial identity class.
You
got to
take the class.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to give out all the information for free, but we'd be here all day.
Yeah.
And I'd have to pull out a couple books because some of the stages are so similar. But basically, it's pre-encounter, encounter, immersion, emersion, and internalization. And so the pre-encounter is right before you push to think about race as a part of who you are. And there's actually different subscales, like how people operate pre-encounter. And then the encounter stage is something that pushes you to think about race. So when the theory was developed, it was during the civil rights movement. So for a lot of black folks, it was the assassination of multiple martyrs, right? Like there was Medgar Evers and Malcolm X and King and Fred Hampton. Like people were being assassinated left and right, and you were being pushed to think about what does it mean to be black in the midst of the civil rights movement. Nowadays, the rash of public visible killings of black, brown bodies at the hands of police violence was something that triggered people to kind of think about what it means. So that was an encounter stage for a lot of young people that pushed them to think about race in terms of who they are. So once you've kind of been woken up and said, oh gosh, I got to figure out what this means, what I'm going to do with it, then there's the theorized immersion stage. So it's where you realize there's a lot you didn't know. And so you immerse yourself in all things your identity, like music and clothing and food and ways of being. But then those deeper things like history, right? So do you understand the history of your people and the myths and lies and distortions that have been given to you or been omitted about your racial or ethnic group? And so that immersion stage is just immersing oneself in all things your racial or ethnic group. And then immersion, you emerge having developed a sense of who you are, and not just in relation to white folks, but in terms of like a deep knowing of who you are and your racial or ethnic group. So not just in the context of racism and the systems that are operating, but in a true way. Mm-hmm. And then internalization is theorized to be where you have a sense of yourself, and you're also able to work with other people and connect with other people of other groups, because for some folks, that immersion stage can be pretty isolating, right? There can be a lot of anger, like, why didn't I learn this? I can't believe, like, what's happening in our system, in our world, that I didn't learn this? And you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, the unknown stories. And that's where the books like Lies My Teacher Told Me or Zinn's History of America's People, like, those books really are not mainstream, although many schools are pulling them in more and more into the curriculum. But historically, you might encounter that in college. You might, if you took the class.
All right, guys, time for part two of this lecture, an abridged lesson on racial identity for white people.
We won't take all day. We'll take the most popular. Helms theory. There's two phases. There's six stages. So the first phase includes contact, disintegration, and reintegration. So that's where you start to kind of understand and dismantle a racist identity. And so the idea there is, in the contact stage, everyone's just an individual. Like, what do you mean, race? I'm colorblind. I'm just me. You're just you. And then disintegration, I think about it as all of that colorblindness and assumptions that everyone is just treated by their own merit and race has nothing to do with that, disintegrates. And something happens that pushes them to see, oh, wait, my experience is not the experience of everyone else. And so for some folks, that's Charlottesville. For some folks, that's Michael Brown's murder. For some folks, that's someone close to them or that they love. You know, they both walk into a store and their friend gets followed, right? There's something that pushes them to have those ideas disintegrate. And then reintegration, and again, just like the other stage, you know, not everyone goes through every stage. People hang out at different rates, but reintegration is where, okay, I've been pushed to think about race in a different way than I was comfortable with, but I'm going to try to pull all that together by blaming the victim. Like, oh, I see that, actually. Yeah, Black people are being killed by police at high rates. Well, if they would just pull up their pants, if they would just do what the officer said, if they would just, right? So the reintegration stage is an attempt to pull all that back together by blaming the victim. Then that second stage is about developing a white identity that's outside of white supremacy. That's a hard thing to do within our society. But it includes pseudo-independent, immersion, and autonomy. And so that pseudo-independent stage is where some white people will try to develop a sense of being white outside of racism by connecting with other cultures. So there's people who are like really into, you know, Latin culture or really into Black culture, and they take that on. And so it's called pseudo-independent because, like, okay, you're not being actively racist, but you've done it by attaching to someone, appropriating someone else's culture. Right. So you're not really independent. You're pseudo-independent. You still haven't.
I'm like thinking of people I know in my life. I'm like, oh God. Oh, okay.
Yes, yes. We could do a whole other show.
Pseudo-independent. That's it. He's pseudo-independent. That's it. He's pseudo-independent.
That's right. You can just.
Right,
You can say that there's science behind this too.
Right,
and you could do a whole analysis on like people in popular culture, and right. So that's pseudo-independent, and then there's immersion, very similar to what it was for people of color, right? White folks who want to figure out what does it mean to be white outside of white supremacy, right. And that's where they dig deep. And I often ask my students, you know, name a person of color who's an active anti-racist. And they can name lots of folks, right? Name a white person who's an active anti-racist. And they're crickets because we don't tell those stories. Mm-hmm. But there have been white people who've been fighting against slavery, racism for centuries. But we don't know their stories. And so who does that benefit, right? Like that benefits the status quo and things mm-hmm. staying the way that they are. So immersion is about white folks getting into their history and understanding not only the white people who have been actively anti-racist forever, but also understanding the cost of, for them, the psychosocial cost of racism to them. Mm-hmm. You often have people who dig deep and they realize, oh, wait, like, actually, my family changed their name. We gave up our language. This is what we lost. And they start to learn and understand how racism not only dehumanizes people of color, but it also dehumanizes white folks as well. And so that immersion stage is about them getting really clear about the history of white people in an actively anti-racist way, but also their own story. And then they come out of that, they also emerge with a sense of whiteness that's not leaning on other cultures mm-hmm. and that is actively anti-racist. And then autonomy is where they also are able to work and connect with people of different racial and ethnic groups with a strong sense of who they are.
So clearly people can be all over the map with this.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens, like, if you decide, like, okay, this is where I am, but you want to be someplace else?
Right, or you want to figure out what to do with the information that you do have about yourself and your place in the world.
I don't want to go toe-to-toe necessarily with people who I know distinctly we're not going to change each other's mind, but I do want to feel more confident in what I can bring to the table.
Depending on where you are on the woke spectrum or identity scale or however you think about it, Charlottesville may have seemed like an inevitable clash or a spontaneous combustion. But regardless, it stands that what happened there once again caused many people to confront white supremacy's grip on this country's past and present.
Yeah, so what do you do if you're trying to figure out what to do next? Good place to start? hang out with this guy, Kenneth Pruitt.
I'm the director of diversity training at Diversity Awareness Partnership.
The Diversity Awareness Partnership does a lot of inclusion training for local companies here in St. Louis, and it's been especially active in the years since Michael Brown's murder. But until Charlottesville, the organization never used that content to help people process a current national event.
And this is the best way that we know how to do it, by bringing people together and figuring out how we respond as a community.
With a few days prep, Kenneth and his staff put together a program they called Listen, Talk, Learn, Responding to White Supremacy. About 50 people showed up to the weeknight forum held at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. And Tim and I went too.
And after a quick recap of the past few weeks, Kenneth starts the program by teeing up this video.
Who are you? I'm not talking about your name or your occupation. I'm talking about something bigger, something deeper.
The video, which leans heavily on European and frankly a lot of male imagery, goes on for about 4 minutes.
And its narrator is the notorious white nationalist Richard Spencer.
An identity you can glimpse in the face of a grandparent or your child. An identity you know through experience.
You know, I was watching people's body language as the video played, and I couldn't help but notice a lot of crossed arms, raised eyebrows, and tilted heads. In fact, the woman sitting closest to me, she looked stunned.
But some also acknowledged that the video was kind of slickly produced.
If you just looked at that video without voiceover, it looked like the Monsanto corn commercial, where they just show happy people frolicking in the field, and then at the end you're like, oh my God, that was about pesticides.
Laughs aside, once this initial listen phase was up, it was time for the second part of the night, the talk part. And for this, there needed to be some segregation.
So, we are going to ask for round one. For if you identify as a person of color, I'm going to ask you to pull your chair into the middle of the room and circle up.
Kenneth calls this the fishbowl exercise. In this case, the fishbowl is a handful of black people circled up as a larger group of white people looks and listens.
If you are not in the middle circle, regardless of which time that is, you have two jobs. One job is to listen carefully, and the other job is to not talk. Okay?
Right away, conversation seems to flow easily after a middle-aged black facilitator kicks things off. We'll let you guys be a fly on the wall for a couple minutes.
Okay, so my first question is, what is your reaction to people's desires to keep the Confederate statues and monuments in public places?
I feel like it's a tactic to attempt to remind us, people of color, people who are not white, who are not cisgender, who are not heterosexual, people who are considered the others, to remind us who's in control.
I think to your point, you know, let's find value in the real conversation. Is it about the statue or what really happened? And let's address that.
I think the issue around the statue is a major distraction. Why are we wasting energy tearing something down? I will tell you, you know, I travel all around Illinois driving a vehicle, and when I come into a small town and I see a statue, then I know to at least pay attention to where I am.
We are no further ahead as a country. And when I look at those statues and what's happening over a statue, to me, the message about the statue and all of what's happening is resounding. And what resounds more than anything is that our own dang president couldn't get on the TV, the Twitter that he likes to tweet all manner of outlandish things, he could not get on TV and say, black people are free. And anything that stands in the way of that freedom, we are not gonna tolerate. I went through Ferguson after the Mike Brown stuff happened. They had the freaking National Guard shooting rubber bullets at people. You had a whole man in a whole car in Charlottesville who drove forward and hit people and then backed up over people. And guess what? He made it safely into court without one bullet at all hitting him. And we have African-American men and women who are being shot in a freaking traffic stop. The monuments are not the biggest issue, but they are a symbol. And they're a symbol of what's residing. And if these are the educated white men who've gotten together and decided that this is the country they want back, they have the political power with the president like that to take us back more than 100 years. And so it makes me very afraid as a black person.
After a few more rounds like this, where the small group discussed varying feelings on whether interracial conversations are helpful and whether they even try to sway someone with white supremacist views, it's time to switch. This time, Kenneth, who we should note is white, sat in the circle with a larger group of white people as the people of color stayed on the outside.
He too starts by asking people how they feel about preserving Confederate symbols. And there were no defenders in this crowd. Which might not be so surprising. After all, these are people who voluntarily showed up to a program about confronting white supremacy. But Kenneth tried to probe deeper and get people to do a little self-reflection.
But white supremacy is just effectively the ideology that white people are supreme, right? But that is not, that doesn't manifest itself in terrible, huge, nefarious ways most of the times. It's very subtle, right? And we live in a culture that still perpetuates in many ways white supremacy, kind of at a default level. So everybody in this circle has benefited from that privilege. So I guess I would also ask, as much as we kind of see these groups as very other, because we would never agree with them, there is something that we are innately responsible for combating that is different than our peers of color. So I guess the question is, what are ways that you benefit from how that ideology plays out? That you could respond to? What are the little ways, not the big, huge ways, that ideology makes its way into your life?
Immediately, one guy raises his hand.
I'm white. I have a penis. I'm tall. I sit on pretty much the biggest pile of privilege there is. I don't have to do that. I don't have to struggle with with how incredibly difficult it is to unwind centuries of social disenfranchisement. The statues seem like just the next iteration of how hard it is to decide what to attack when everything's attacking you. I was just reading about Homi G. Phillips Hospital when it was closed. It was such a controversy in the community because to some, it was a symbol of segregation. It was an all-black hospital. To some, it was a symbol of pride. It was this incredible institution that had educated African-American nurses and doctors that were spread all over the country. So this same thing was both, because it's sitting inside a system that's conflicted. And attempting to pull all those roots up at once is impossible, and trying to decide what roots to pull up is just a Herculean task that I have never had to face.
But, as Kenneth reminded this group, this is the time that people, especially white people, have to face things. And as the conversation went on, one woman confessed she struggled with the idea of trying to change white supremacist minds.
I'm not really that interested in bringing them to the table to have a conversation. And I think that the power lies in there being a greater number of white people speaking out than there are convincing white supremacists that they're wrong.
Again, Kenneth turned the conversation back to action.
Where do we center our conversations with folks who may see that kind of ideology as attractive?
So I can speak to that a bit.
This last voice belongs to Julie Mahoney. She's a writer and lives about an hour outside of the city of St. Louis.
I am white. But I'm also a daughter of a narcissist, so I've struggled with not having my voice heard, not being valued in my family system. And so conflict is frightening to me on any level. And fear of confrontation sort of way, I decided that putting myself out there on Facebook a little more would be a good first step.
It's been bumpy. After sharing a news article that included the viewpoints of Trump supporters, Julie says other white people jumped on her for amplifying views they didn't agree with.
In another case, an old classmate who Julie says is a conservative challenged her about a link she posted to an essay by Garrison Keillor. You public radio nerds out there like us probably recognize his name.
So I wrote back and said, I posted that because I'm a writer and it was stellar writing. And he goes, that's when he said, well, what about the content? And I said, I put it on my page. I'm good with the content. And I understand that you're not going to post the same things, and that's what makes America beautiful. I don't want to go toe-to-toe necessarily with people who I know distinctly we're not going to change each other's mind, but I do want to feel more confident in what I can bring to the table, and I felt like this was a safe place to practice that.
I think that's probably a good enough spot as any to actually close up our conversation if y'all are cool with it.
So after going to this event, the question that both of us, I think, walked away with was, does this help? I mean, you know, going to a conference room, talking about race on a weeknight, what's this add up to? Does it work, basically?
Yeah. I mean, we basically just asked the people who were there, and many of them said yes.
Yeah, I feel validated.
Rachel Smith is a diversity and inclusion leader at Washington University. Her voice may sound familiar. She was the first one to speak up during the fishbowl exercise.
I feel much different than I felt the Monday after Charlottesville, right? You know, the Monday after Charlottesville, I remember sitting in Caldy's across the street from WashU, looking around the room at, you know, my fellow Caldians, right? And the majority of them were Caucasian men and, you know, Caucasian women. And for the first time, I was nervous.
But Rachel says she refuses to walk around feeling unsafe in her own skin.
I had to figure out what needs to happen to move me out of that unhealthy space, because I can't function. I can't live. I don't know if I told you this, but I have 4 kids. Right? And I can't raise kids from a place of fear. I refuse to do that. So it was really the motivation to be in a healthier place.
That desire, Rachel says, is what made her show up.
It helps to know that you're not by yourself, and it helps to have other people have a willingness to have that conversation with you, right? That helps in many ways. And then also being equipped with, guess what? You can do something, and this is what I want you to do. This is what you can do. Have an openness to have conversations with people that you might run from. And this is how you have these conversations. Base it in empathy, right? Base it in a willingness to understand that their perspective is fear-based. They feel like they don't belong. And be willing to encourage them that there is space, and when you need to step away and recover, then that's what you do, right? So it's a process. It's a process. I'm much better than I was following Charlottesville. I think I would have sat through this video that the session was started with. I probably would have cried, like, throughout the entirety of the video. And that didn't happen, which was good.
So maybe after listening to this show, you have your own ideas about what woke is, what the woke spectrum is, about racial identity theory, whatever. We are always listening, and you can find us definitely on Twitter at WeLiveHereSTL.
Or you could send us an email at info@WeLiveHere.show.
That's it. I think it's time for the credits.
I think it is. We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd. Shula Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.